So I'm going to probably go through my presentation maybe a little bit more superficially than I otherwise would. That works well for me because this is a very raw sort of work in progress that I'm presenting, and so I can just give you the vague impression that I'm at least raising interesting questions, even if I don't have any real solutions or big ideas about them yet. But before I do that, I just want to make sure that in my role as the last presenter of the group, I invite anyone here today who's interested in being part of the George Consortium affinity group, which sounds a little odd to me, but project, whatever we call it, should feel free to contact, and I'll nominate myself as point person. I should have put my email address right up here, but it's very simple. It's just my last name, wiley@american.edu, which is easy to remember. And also feel free to come up to talk to any of us about how you can get involved. Getting involved at this point mostly involves having mostly depressing conversations about the state of the legal environment for public health law, but we're working on, and many of these presentations are aimed at, sort of a pivot from the conversations we've been having amongst ourselves over the last year and a half or so about these concerns that we have about things like preemption and First Amendment protection for corporate speech and political kind of broad anti-paternalistic sentiment, to move a little past that and toward, if not complete optimism, at least sort of what I'm thinking of as a more constructive engagement with it, rather than just coming away from each of our discussions feeling deeply depressed. So in the interest of that constructive engagement with these concerns, I'm going to be talking about an aspect of sort of that constructive response that I've been thinking a lot about in a variety of projects, and that's how do we both build and honor and sort of secure some of the coalitions that public health historically has relied on in these increasingly controversial times. And this is something that you can have a discussion about in a variety of contexts. I've thought about it a bit in the context of environmental health and potential tensions between public health groups and environmental groups. I think emerging tensions potentially with sort of the foodie, kind of real food justice movement in public health. That's one whole area for this. Another big area that I've been thinking about is potential coalitions with private health plans who are interested in cutting their costs by providing incentives for healthy behavior, and some of the tensions with good, sound public health practice that those developments present. But rather than trying to touch on those multiple contexts, I'm going to focus on one in particular today. And that's a few different controversies that are emerging between where public health groups, not uniformly, but at least some voices in public health, are positioning themselves on the opposite side of an issue from civil rights groups, as well as anti-poverty and anti-hunger groups. And so I want to start with a quote from Dan Beecham. I think that a lot of our conversation today kind of goes back to some of his work. It's easy for us within the public health community to assume that sort of our goals are very much compatible with the broader goals of social justice, including things like civil rights and anti-poverty. We tend to assume that we are good progressives who agree with the goals of those other advocacy movements. But in recent years, and particularly coming to the fore over the last several months or so, we've seen a range of controversies, some of them focused on obesity, others less so, that create kind of these new tensions between public health and other sort of what I'll call progressive advocacy groups. I'm going to touch on three in this area. I'm going to go back to the Big Gulp ban, although I don't like to call it that. It's the New York City sugary drinks portion rule, food stamp restrictions, proposals to restrict the use of food stamps for, you know, either sugary beverages and candy on the one hand, or to restrict them to a defined basket of healthy goods, a la WIC, on the other. And then finally, something that seems a bit different, but I'm going to use it to point to what I think is a more positive result in a controversy that's a little farther along in its development, and that's primary enforcement seatbelt laws and controversy over racial profiling that has been discussed and actually is actively being discussed right now in the Massachusetts state legislature in a way that I think is very productive for both public health and our allies in the civil rights and criminal justice community. So in talking about these, I have a few questions that I've been thinking about and that I'll just raise for discussion either in our Q&A or afterwards in the hallway. One of the big questions in my mind with regard to paternalism issues and kind of when we bump up against industry interests, but also in this specific context about other progressive advocacy groups is, does it really just come down to following the money? Groups that have been looking at some of these tensions I'm going to talk about are quick to point out that NAACP and some of the anti-hunger groups are taking money from the industries that public health wants to represent, and that's the end of this discussion, right? Maybe we help wean them off that bad money, but there's really not any more to it than that in terms of examining our own the battles that we're picking. I'm also interested in thinking about how we can make the case for public health as a civil rights and poverty issue. I think within the public health community, we tend to assume that we don't need to do that, right? We see ourselves as deeply committed to social justice, and we just sort of assume that that affinity is very clear to other progressive advocacy groups, but I think it's much less clear on their side than we tend to assume that it is. And then along those lines, not just can we make the case better, but can we back up, are we doing enough to back up our commitment to social justice in terms of our advocacy priorities and the battles that we're picking? Is there more that we can do? All right, so I'm going to start with the Bloomberg soda portion rule. And I'm sure that lots of you are familiar with the basic contours of that, 16 ounces as a cap for sales of sugary beverages in food service establishments. One of the big controversies was over the fact that it doesn't actually apply to the Big Gulp, right? It doesn't apply to grocers and corner stores. Something that was less well understood is that the reason for that is that they aren't regulated by the health code to which the portion rule was an amendment, right? It applies to the food service establishments that are governed by that existing code, which is promulgated by the Board of Health, by the city. Those corner stores and grocery stores, on the other hand, are regulated at the state level by a distinct state-level agency. But this seemingly very arbitrary distinction was one of the main bases of the legal challenges that we've seen that are now still ongoing. Wendy said defeated, but it's still going, right? It's state Supreme Court has taken the appeal, so that controversy rages on. Certainly defeated in the media though, and you know, lots of coverage of the two court decisions so far that have struck down the rule as unconstitutional under the state constitution. In these lawsuits, I think it's incredibly important that industry has made a very careful strategic choice about how to present this litigation. The first two, the sort of named plaintiffs in the caption in this case, it's not the American Beverage Association, it's not the Restaurant Association, it's the statewide coalition of Hispanic Chambers of Commerce and the Korean American Grocers Association. And that was a very, you know, clear strategic choice on their part. Another move that got a lot of press attention was that it's been sort of portrayed as the NAACP itself filed this amicus brief. In fact, I think it's important to note it was the New York State Conference, which historically also played a pretty big role in opposing some of the smoke-free laws in New York. So it wasn't nearly as shocking as maybe it was portrayed as being. And it also wasn't coming from the national organization. It was coming from the state conference. The state conferences actually have quite a lot of independence and independent authority in the structure of the organization. So NAACP and the Hispanic Federation filed an amicus brief in the case. And I think this is sort of the best encapsulation I can find of kind of what their position was about why they saw this as an issue that these two groups needed to weigh in on. And it boiled down to sort of the idea that the sort of arbitrary distinction between food service establishments on the one hand and groceries and corner stores on the other was ultimately going to disproportionately affect minority-owned businesses. There's really not any good evidence for that. Many of the corner stores that are regulated are also small minority-owned businesses, and many of the food service establishments that are regulated are not small family-owned businesses. They're large restaurant chains. But in any case, that was part of the argument. And then to a lesser extent, They argued that the ban disproportionately affects freedom of choice on the part of consumers in low-income communities. And that aspect of it also got quite a lot of attention in things like Slate posts and Huffington Post short articles about how this was because consumption of sugary drinks is higher among, say, the African-American community or Hispanic communities in New York, that this was in some way targeted at them, or at least it was going to have a disparate impact on those communities. I thought this was a great exchange. If you haven't seen it, you can watch the video online. It's pretty easy to find. This was an exchange on CNN around the time of the amicus brief being filed. And Victor Blackwell says to Hazel Dukes, who is the president of the New York State Conference and was also the president of the New York State Conference during the time of the sort of NAACP weighing in against smoke-free laws, why is the NAACP in this fight? And almost immediately after the amicus brief was filed, you also saw a lot of reports saying, look, this is about following the money. These organizations take quite a bit of money from Coke in particular, but Pepsi as well. And that money is clearly swaying their position. They're reliant on it. I think there's something to that, but if you look a little more carefully, and there's actually a really great piece in a nonprofit organizations journal, that really parsed kind of, well, how much money are we talking about, and is it really enough to influence an organization to completely disregard the interests of its constituents? And maybe it wasn't quite enough. I mean, I think the other aspect of what's going on here is that the leaders of these two organizations, at least at the state level, also seem to have sort of an economically conservative orientation, sort of along the lines of what Newt Gingrich sometimes suggests, that these organizations need to understand and need to convey to their constituents that economic growth is in the interests of African Americans and Hispanic communities as well. Demand jobs, not food stamps, has been Newt Gingrich's line. And I think that sort of dynamic has also been in play here, right? That the role of the NAACP should be to protect the business interests of minority-owned businesses, at least as much as it should be to protect sort of entitlement programs or other kinds of measures that have been more traditionally the role of the focus of these organizations. But my question is whether this is more than just the money, and whether we can do more to make our case. In thinking about kind of the ethics of public health policies that maybe disproportionately impact a minority or underrepresented community, we tend to go to the idea that, well, they're disproportionately enjoying the benefits of this intervention. And so if the burdens are disproportionate, that might be okay so long as the benefits are also disproportionately enjoyed by a particular community. And I think that makes some sense, but I'm not sure that's adequate to really, as a framework for thinking about sort of how we make these decisions about when we might need to really rethink our stance on an issue like this. I think another piece of that you sometimes see, but it tends to get shorter shrift, is the idea that that public health is regulating an industry that specifically targets these communities, that is targeting minority communities. And what I love about this slide is that you've got two ads that are clearly targeting sort of women of color who are heads of households, right? It almost even looks like it could be the same actor in both billboards. And the first one is an ad about sort of encouraging families to get assistance in the form of SNAP benefits or food stamps. You probably can't see at the bottom. It says food stamps can help. Childhood obesity, don't take it lightly. And it's a food and vegetable initiative. You can't quite see the logo. And then, of course, McDonald's, my kind of shopping spree, right? Bring home fries and soda and Big Macs to your kids for dinner tonight. And so I think thinking about the role that organizations like the NAACP or Hispanic Federation might play in countering industry efforts to target the communities that they represent might be a little more productive. I also think that that there might be an opportunity here to provide more support to individuals with public health expertise working within these organizations who are actually quite amenable to trying to kind of shift the position of the organizations with regard to public health issues. NAACP actually has a fairly kind of well-developed program on that's sort of an anti-obesity, anti-diabetes program, but it's really based on a fairly outdated model of public health, probably intentionally because it avoids generating any controversy. It's very much about this kind of education and personal responsibility and especially parental responsibility to make better choices and, like, let's get physically active, right? But there are organizations within the NAACP, offices within the NAACP that are staffed by people with very sophisticated public health expertise who are very interested in doing more policy advocacy of the sort that public health experts are starting to favor, kind of these environmental changes, food retail environment changes. And there might be more that we can do to support that kind of effort to shift the organization toward a little bit of a more sort of progressive stance on public health policy and move it a little bit away from just that personal responsibility, parental responsibility, be physically active approach. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about another controversy. On that last one, I'm leaning toward the idea that ultimately we're right about things like the portion rule and that the sort of potential for a disproportionate impact on minority communities maybe isn't as concerning as groups are representing it to be. On this one, I'm a little more concerned, and I think we really do need to re-examine the stance that at least some public health experts are taking on this. So as many of you may know, but some others may not be as familiar with this, USDA at the federal level says that SNAP benefits can be used for virtually any food or beverage product as long as it's not alcohol or tobacco, and as long as it's not hot prepared food. Beyond that, you can use it to buy candy and soda and whatever junk food you like. Going back to, I think, 2004, you've got some states and some city governments interested in seeking a waiver from USDA to change that. A waiver would be necessary because the state and city governments don't have the authority to do it on their own. They have to get permission from the federal government to change the rules in the model of an experiment, essentially, right, a pilot program. USDA has consistently rejected those requests for a waiver and taken the position that this isn't the right approach, that we shouldn't restrict SNAP benefits. And they're not alone in doing so. Anti-hunger groups vehemently oppose these proposals to restrict the use of SNAP benefits. And what they say, if you look closely at their argument, is, look, what you need to understand is that these programs are incredibly vulnerable politically. And they're even more vulnerable right now than they have been in recent memory. I don't know if you guys saw the news headlines. I think it was something like 48 million Americans had their benefits cut last Friday because of some SNAP cuts. And the Congress is actively discussing much deeper SNAP cuts as they take up the farm bill again. For the debate over the 5-year farm bill, there are much steeper cuts on the table there. And so organizations like the Food Research Action Campaign argue that if we are starting to characterize this as sort of poor people wasting your taxpayer dollars on soda and sugary snacks and salty foods, that really makes the program even more vulnerable. And in fact, if you look at some of the USDA kind of reports over what can SNAP do to promote healthier eating, the main proposal that's discussed and refuted for the most part, but it's kind of set up as a straw man, is, well, maybe we should cut SNAP, right? If obesity is the problem, maybe we shouldn't be giving people money to buy food. Maybe they need less food, right? We, as public health experts, know that that's not quite how that works. But I think it's important for us to understand that that is what's out there as the potential response, and that there really could be something to this idea of a slippery slope from restricting the use of SNAP benefits to just cutting SNAP benefits. So the response that a lot of public health groups have given to the kind of anti-hunger and anti-poverty groups' concerns is, look, follow the food stamps this time, right? The food stamps amount to an enormous subsidy for unhealthy food and beverage groups. And more so than that, these anti-hunger and anti-poverty groups are actually taking money from many of those food and beverage industry groups. And that has been a long-standing sort of synergistic relationship between anti-hunger groups and the food industry, right? Corn Growers Association and many of the processed food companies do contribute money to anti-hunger groups. And many anti-hunger programs, federal programs, have historically amounted to essentially subsidy programs and were designed that way even. So it is a concern. But I think we need to take their concerns, the concerns of these groups, even though they're accepting what we think of as bad money, a little more seriously than we have been. I think you don't have to go very far in terms of scratching the surface of the kind of people we are now allying ourselves with instead of these anti-hunger and anti-poverty groups to start to be a little feel a little uneasy about these new alliances that we're sort of hooking up with. On the one hand, it's very appealing to try to be bipartisan, particularly in a time where many of the things that we might most want to do are getting incredibly politically difficult, right? If we could point to a success and say, look, as Bloomberg has, this is something we can do without costing the taxpayers a dime, and it's going to make a real difference, and it's great, and it's politically quite feasible, that's tempting to sort of jump on that bandwagon and say, yes, we can make this a success. This is something we can achieve, even in a very difficult time. But this is a statement from Rhonda Storms, who is the Florida state senator who supported, who introduced a food stamp restriction bill in Florida that was ultimately unsuccessful. And she said a number of grocery store cashiers had told her that customers on food stamps would buy junk food, but then it gets a little more interesting, right? Prime rib, lobster, and other extravagant foods. This bill would introduce a little fiscal responsibility to the program. Sound familiar? All right, so I think we need to rethink some of the battles that we're picking. I think we need to think about whether in trying to be bipartisan, we might be ultimately alienating some of our some groups that we've had good coalitions with in the past. And we might even be hurting our efforts to pursue more productive strategies in the long term. If you see, for example, I'll go back, in a state like South Carolina, when you see Nikki Haley stepping up and saying, look, you know, South Carolina is the, I think, second highest diabetes risk in the United States. We've really got to do something about this. And the cornerstone of my plan is to restrict food stamp benefits for the poor. I'm not sure that's sort of the strategy that we want to hitch our wagon to. All right, so one last controversy, and I'm really running out of time. But I think this one points toward a kind of a potential sort of more positive path forward in terms of strengthening these coalitions. And this is primary enforcement seatbelt laws. This is something that's in the research literature on primary enforcement. Not only that primary enforcement works very, very well, it really does achieve significant gains in terms of seatbelt usage, it also eliminates disparities. But then when you start looking at, well, why is that, right? So everyone's seatbelt usage goes up, but African-American seatbelt usage really goes up when you move to primary enforcement. And researchers actually posit, they do it in sort of very careful language, that it may be tied to a perception among blacks of an increased likelihood of being ticketed for seatbelt law violations because of the potential for differential enforcement, which is a nice way of saying racial profiling, right? There's some studies that would suggest that it's not the case necessarily that racial profiling increases under a primary enforcement regime, but it's at least as bad as the sort of underlying level of racial profiling. There's really high levels of disparities in traffic stops. I'm going to get this wrong. I shouldn't do it off the cuff, but I think in Mississippi, some ridiculous percentage, like 88% of traffic stops are African-American drivers in the state of Mississippi. There's a lot of racial profiling in traffic stops. And so lots and lots of states successfully moved to primary enforcement over the last 15 years or so, but there have been some holdouts, and Massachusetts has been one of them. Massachusetts in the 80s actually moved to primary enforcement and then repealed the law almost immediately. And then it's been working, advocates have been working to get a primary enforcement law every few years since then. There's one currently in committee, in the Public Safety Committee in the Massachusetts State Legislature, and the reason that it looks like it might be getting closer to success than any of the recent efforts have is because of a compromise that's been brokered by Deval Patrick. And what you've got there, and you've seen it in, I believe, Maryland did something similar, although the Massachusetts approach is a little stronger, is that they've married this primary enforcement seatbelt law provision with an anti-racial profiling provision that both sort of creates a prohibition on racial profiling and traffic stops, as well as provides for the collection of data about traffic stops and the racial status of stopped drivers. And as well as sort of a couple of other provisions that are even stronger than that. One of them says that the data that's collected about any given officer should be made available to criminal defendants in trials where there's evidence arising out of a traffic stop, right? The relevant officer's profile of traffic stops should be made available to the defendant as a basis for impeaching that evidence. And then finally, there's also a provision, and I think this is potentially the strongest part of the bill, that says that when there's a traffic stop, if the seatbelt is the sole reason for the stop, the officer may not conduct a search. Based on that alone, and that's pretty huge. Criminal justice colleagues of mine tell me that it could be made even stronger if it followed a Rhode Island anti-racial profiling law and actually prohibited even consent searches in those situations. What she tells me is that in many cases the cop just says, well, he consented, right? And it's sort of your word against his about whether you consented or not. But if you essentially say to them, you can't even ask to search the car at that point, then that would be a very powerful anti-profiling provision. So I think bundling these two things together, as the Boston Globe said late last year, is potentially very powerful and a win-win. And I think those win-wins are really important for us right now. It shouldn't just be about sort of how can we use other progressive advocacy groups to further our own causes. It needs to be a little more two-sided than that, right? And to the extent that we can help promote goals that don't necessarily have a public health objective, but that are things that are sort of sympathetic or synergistic with our broader social justice goals, I think that can be a really important move that we can make right now. So those are sort of the questions that I wanted to raise for now. This is very much a project that I'm still thinking about and mulling over, and I hope that we can have some discussion of the other presentations and maybe these issues as well, if not during our time now, later in the hallway. Thanks so much.